It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy Fanny Show.
Talking about where kind with Alma Alexander.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest today is Alma Alexander. Hello, Alma.
Hi, guys.
So really quick, before we dive into the book, you want to say a little bit about your publishing history and a little bit about yourself so folks can know everything about you there is to know.
Well, I've been asked how long I've been writing, and I've had to say for as long as I've been holding a pencil in my hand, and before that I told lies. So I've been doing this for a really long time. I've been full-time for... Quit that, cat. I've been doing that for the full-time for over 15 years now, and I've had about 12, 13, I can't lost count, novels published so far. One of them is out in 14 languages worldwide, and I call that my blessed book, The Secrets of Jin Shea, which is kind of running wild. It sold 50,000 copies in hardcover in Spain in 2 months, which is still blowing my mind. But aside from that, I kind of write the gamut of fantasy, from high fantasy to contemporary, so-called contemporary fantasy, to everything in between. YA has been a sort of thing that I never really set out to do, but somehow this is my second YA series, the Weir Chronicles, of which Random is book one of. It's my second YA series, so somehow I landed in the YA corral. I'm not quite sure why, but I'm enjoying it.
Well, excellent. So to sort of start off, so this is a book that I think must draw on a lot of your personal experience, given that you originally from Yugoslavia and have traveled probably more of the world than I can probably count on a single hand, probably more, yeah, many hands, I think. And this book, Random, deals with an immigrant family who are were kind, who have come to America, and it sort of deals with the different generations. And I hope you might talk about the way in which this might have connected with some of your personal life.
Well, I never really specify it's America, although it obviously is. It's partly... If you cast your mind back to the book, there is a particular part of Celia's diary where she writes down the words she gets wrong when she gets teased in the schoolyard and she's learning the language and she mispronounces things. That was me. That was how I learned English. I learned English in the schoolyard in a school when I said something wrong and they teased me to death about it. I never said it wrong again. English is my second language. I learned it when I was 10 years old, and I think and dream in it now. It's just beyond first language, but I did learn it when I was older, and I learned it the hard way, and I never learned it the formal way. I never learned it at school doing grammar. I couldn't parse a sentence for you if you killed me, but I know how to use one. The whole immigrant acceptance thing, it kind of does and kind of doesn't. I mean... It's really kind of hard to say that any single thing of that book actually connects back to anything specific in my life. But there are strings, and there's things that are kind of visible in the background. And it isn't true. I made up a lot of stuff on the fly, but it's real. It's true in the sense that it's true for somebody. A lot of immigrant families, a lot of people who are different, who are other, who are not integral or born into a society or a place, will find these problems arising. The language, the different culture, the different way of looking at things, the different necessities that they want or need in their lives. And sometimes there's just the communication sometimes just doesn't happen because of the simple fact that people are on different wavelengths.
Julie, do you have a follow-up to that?
Yeah, so you mentioned the scene where she's talking about the different words that she's getting wrong and how awry is not a re and it's not the same as envy, and she's getting teased on the school ground and she's writing everything out phonetically. Mm-hmm. And you say that that's coming from your own experience. And that was one of the things that struck me, and I wondered when I read it, like, is that something that you had lived before? But another thing that really struck me about it was the importance of names and the way that when they chose to leave, when they had to leave, they had to choose new names that were not the same as their old names. And I wondered kind of, especially since names in folklore are so significant, like in fairy tales, usually if people know your true name, they have power over you. And I wondered kind of what went into that logic. Did you actually have experience of changing your name? Is this something that you are drawing from the folklore from? Where was the important source of that?
I think that you carry a lot of your identity with you, with your name, inevitably. And there are a lot of writers who will tell you that they are capable of writing an entire character, starting with character X and just leaving character X in place and writing the whole story about character X and just naming the character in the end, which I've never been able to do. People in my books tend to come out of the woodwork with their names in their hands and say, this is what my name is, deal. And with these guys, I never really set out to do that, but it just felt like the sort of thing that somebody with a family name or a family name sort of tradition that didn't belong in a new world would do or try to do to get their kids to fit in better. I have a lot of friends who cannot for the life of them read a Russian novel because they get lost in the names. You know, the patronymics, the nicknames that have apparently nothing to do with the actual given name. People just get lost in that and kind of go, who are we talking about now? With me, it's in here. It's in my head. And I instinctively know because I come from that kind of background. I come from that kind of ideological setup. So I know exactly how it works. But I have a feeling that a lot of people who came out here, for example, you know, the movie stars like, Kirk Douglas had a vaguely foreign name before he became Kirk Douglas because people would never remember how to remember and spell it.
That's really interesting. I also thought it was especially interesting given that they had to choose different names and that she couldn't be Svetlana or Svetya. But then when they named Jazz, originally her name is Jessica and then her nickname for that is Jazz, which is really not something that we would normally think of as a nickname for Jessica. So I think it's interesting that you say people have trouble with the Russian names and the nicknames apparently having nothing to do with the original name, but then you can have something like Jazz as a nickname for Jessica and people here would not blink at that.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go back to a basic thing, because I'm assuming that most people who are listening to this have not read the book at all and don't understand anything about the plot. And I was wondering if you would explain a little bit about the premise of it, because you have were people, but it's very different from weres that I've encountered in other books. So tell us about that and how you came up with the whole world.
Well, the thing about this is that it basically started out as a short story. There was an anthology that was pitched out there about the weir kind. And I was going to do a story for that, and I started writing a story. And as happens with me a lot of the time, I was suddenly 5,000 words into the story, and I realized I hadn't said hello yet, and this world was getting to be bigger and darker than I ever had expected it to be. The original short story started out being rather funny because I'd hit on this idea of the random weir, which I don't think I've ever seen anywhere before. And the idea there is that these are weir creatures who have their basic form in which they turn if nothing else happens. But if they happen to lay eyes on another warm-blooded creature while in the midst of their turn or just before their turn, they'll turn into that. And the potential for classic comedic chaos is amazing. I mean, the mother of these kids that I'm writing about happens to be a weird chicken because of an unfortunate farmyard accident. She happens to be a random weir, and she happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and she happened... Well, you get the rest. But the thing is, the random weir is something that just came out of absolutely left field, and I'm not quite sure where that came from, but that suddenly started informing my entire premise, because what I set out to do is... And again, this is not something I've seen done anywhere else. Because I've got a scientific background, I've actually got a master's degree in molecular biology, and I actually set out to produce a molecular, genetic, pharmacological, physiological, biological basis for being weird. The way this would work if they existed, if they were among us right now. And that was an immense amount of unanticipated fun, because I was suddenly going back to my origins and using things that I left behind a long time ago. I mean, I worked in a lab, I did research, I did all that, but then I went sideways and I did scientific writing, and then after that I started writing fiction. So I was literally going back to an older time and picking things up from the past. And what I did with the weir is I created a whole world for them, background for them, in which they could and do exist as creatures equal to ourselves. And the inevitable consequence of that is that, given the fact that I put them into a society such as the Not Quite America that I used as my setting, I used the rule of law to keep them, how can I put this, corralled, because there is a sort of fear that it would be inevitable with the mundane, the normal, the non-wear, looking around at these critters who suddenly turn into a bear or a wolf or whatever. And in some ways I was exploring the idea that, you know, how does the rule of law limit one's own freedom? And if you are afraid, if you're too afraid of something, do you use law to kill it?
Sean, are you going to jump in?
I'm sorry, I was muted, and then I started talking the question, and then realized I was still muted. So
okay, I was wondering where you were.
Yeah.
Should I count us in so that you can actually like cut straight
remove
to your question?
Remove this awkward silence. Yes. Yeah. Go ahead,
okay.
And again, thank you.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So this was actually related to one of the fascinating things about the book for me, because once our main character Jazz starts perusing, or at least telling us about these letters she's found from her sister about her experiences in school, we start to see the varying levels at which this sort of othering process it takes place. And it's, on the one hand, as you note, right, the law is a big part of it. The big factor being that they have to go to these turning houses if they don't have a place of their own in which to be quote unquote locked up during their turn, as a mechanism of fear. But you also have the same levels of control being exhibited not only within the hierarchy of the students, but also within in relationship to some of the teachers who are authority figures in their own right. And this is so fascinating to see so much detail into that element of this story, because usually you get kind of a dystopian tale and it'll be very much focused on the government, but to have so much focus on those social interactions and the damage that they can do really resonated with me. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about how you were developing that to kind of give Celia that, give her a character essentially through her journals.
The premise that I was starting from was the scientific one, which I wanted to do because science. But the other leg of this story is the social thing, because one of the major strands in this book is the idea of bullying, is the idea of discrimination, is a sort of a light in the darkness for a lot of kids out there who might be dealing with these problems right now, although they don't happen to be weird, but they might be I don't know, different race, a different creed, a different sexuality, different something that makes them stand out from the herd and therefore vulnerable to it. There's a lot of darkness out there that I think that some of it gets seen, but some of it gets kind of kids will be kids kind of thing. And it's not that easy. Kids are kids, but they feel things just as deeply and just as hard and often more so. And one of the things that I wanted to deal with in this book, and I've always said that I always thought of fantasy as a way through to the truth of it all, because you can say things when it's wrapped up in the silver tissue of fantasy lies that are really hard to get across when you try and tell it straight. And I'm telling a straight story, but it's a fantasy overlay, and people are going to read this and possibly recognize the reality of it without being trampled by it. And I'm really passionately aware of the fact that these books may be some of the most important things I've ever written, simply because they're dealing with these really difficult questions. And part of the things that I'm hoping to do is put this weapon in the hands of somebody who may or may not be able to deal with it otherwise, but realizing by reading these books that, no, we're not alone and there's others like us.
Yeah, I think that message really does come through quite strong, particularly as Jazz is kind of coming to terms with how much her own life has been affected by what has happened to her family coming from the quote-unquote the old country and having been persecuted there, but then also to sort of be the one child who is not really part of that history anymore. I mean, she is in the sense that it's her ancestry, but she's born in the not quite United States, but is kind of the United States.
Right.
She's in the new world, that is, you describe it as the new world.
She's got a double kind of burden of problems, because she's got to deal with all that baggage because it's hers. But she's also got to deal with the fact that she has to survive in this new jungle.
Yeah, and that certainly is something that for her becomes so difficult, because she doesn't understand the hierarchy that exists around her, because so much is being kept for her own safety. I mean, her parents are not telling her stuff because they want her to have an okay life, but the end result of that is that she's discovering all these really horrific things that have happened to people who've been afraid to talk about them, including her sister, and even from people as we learn from Nell, who is from a sort of higher ranking non-random Ware family, who herself is, there's things that she can't tell because of her own station to some degree. Was that something that you had really wanted to kind of unpack, was the nature of which young people kind of feel trapped in a world where adults are leaving things out?
I wanted to get across an idea of, yes, possibly protect the children, but don't protect them from the things that will help them. And quite often, telling the truth to children is the harder way to do things, but in the long run, it's the only way to get the children to survive unscathed, but that's not quite true, less scathed than they would otherwise have been. Too many layers of lies, and you can't fight your way out from underneath them anymore.
Julia?
So one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this was that you have a significant portion of it told through Jazz having a password-protected, friends-locked blog. And she and some of her friends are actually interacting online. And I thought that was a really interesting way of telling it, because that's how she posts her sister's journal entries, which she's sharing with this select group of friends. And then they have their comments back and forth. And I wondered if that was something that you thought of as a way that kids reading this book might see as a model of how they could also have a support network, because maybe they can't find it in their daily life at school, but maybe they can find it on the internet. Is this something that you personally have experienced? Is it something that you would think other people could get a lot out of?
Oh, yes, she's a very modern werewolf. The thing about that is that, yeah, I have a huge platform of of cyberspace friends, some of whom I've never met in my life, but some of whom I really count amongst some of my closest friends ever. And it doesn't necessarily mean in today's connected age that if you don't have somebody sitting right next to you, that they are not there for you. They will be. They can be. And if what I'm trying to say in one sense is look for support where you can find it, and you can find it in some really strange places these days. Our parents wouldn't think to look online to connect with people like that. My own mom is using Skype to talk to her sisters overseas, and is using that as a very matter-of-fact way. But the first time that happened, the first Skype conversation, she and her sister both cried. Because this was a completely unnatural thing to do, to sit in front of the computer and see a video of a person who's talking to you. And they hadn't seen each other for years. So the newfangled, you know, systems or means of communication are the things that our children, our the next generation, is so used to, is so accepting of, that it's almost inevitable that they will gravitate towards that in some sense in seeking their own circles.
Do you want me to go, Julia? I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
Awkward moment. It's okay. Yeah, I mean, the technology aspect, I mean, you're right that the newer generation, they're to that point where they just don't even recognize it as a thing. I mean, like Skype is so ubiquitous now, like it's on phones, or the fact that we have cell phones, I mean, that can play video games on them and stuff is so just normal. It's not even, like, fascinating anymore. It's like, I mean, how many iPhones are they going to release this year? Like 19 different versions? So it's very interesting that you know, that there isn't more work for young people that is actually dealing with that technological aspect. And I think that's one of the interesting things that your book is doing, is that it's exploring two different mediums. It's exploring kind of old form written medium, but also the way in which that can be shared in this sort of this newer, more ubiquitous medium, and yet at the same time is being withheld because it's being put into cyberspace, but only people that have access can get it, which I thought was really interesting. I don't think I have a question. It's just a comment. That's totally...
Well, the third book in the series, every book in this series is being told by a different point of view character. The second book, the wolf, second book is being told but from the point of view of Mal, which is Jazz's brother. And the third book is being told from the point of view of the hacker character, who bears the remarkable name of Saladin from Skalquake, who you have to read the book to find out why, but who is generally known as Chalky because nobody can pronounce that preposterous surname. But he's essentially a hacker, and the things that he does online are kind of becoming legendary here. But he lives out there. This is his world. He knows how to deal with that. And quite honestly, I just finished writing the third book, and this character, the Chalky character, he's one of the best characters I've ever written in my life, and it's going to be so hard to say goodbye to these kids.
So it seems like you get really attached to your characters.
I do. They're real. They're all real to me. They're people who I've lived with now for 2 years, and it's like, don't go, come back.
You may be the first author that we've interviewed that has actually been so... I mean, I should note to the people that are listening on the podcast, we can see Alma. She has her video on, and you can see, like, when she's talking about a character, she, like, her face gets bright. She's excited. It's the first kind of moment in which I've seen an author, like, get just giddy excited about her characters in a sort of very emotional way. And I'm curious where that comes from for you. I mean, how is it that you have keyed into your characters in such an emotional way?
I've been on a lot of panels at cons. So how do you create your characters? And my usual response to that is I shouldn't be on this panel because I don't create my characters. I kind of see them walk into a room. They sit down next to me and they say, here, I'll dictate you right. And I've had characters tap me on the shoulder quite literally and say, I didn't say that. I live with these creatures for years, for months, for years, and I just it's really hard to say goodbye to them. There was one book that I wrote early on in my career, which became two books, The Hidden Queen and Changer of Days duology, which was essentially one book, which the publisher split into two parts. And I wrote that, and I got to a certain point that my two protagonists were sitting on the backs of horses on the middle of a mountain winter, just staring at this white deer. And I left it there, and I left it there, and I left it there. And finally, a friend of mine said, are you ever going to get them out of there before they die of terminal frostbite? And I realized that the reason that I left them there so long is because the next scene was the end of the book, and I really didn't want to let them go. So I basically just let them freeze to death quietly and slowly before I would permit them to leave my orbit. But I do get attached to my characters. I talk to them. They talk to me. The stories that I tell are not my stories. They're their stories. Sometimes they come up with things that I have no idea where they came from, but it's not me. It's them. It's this particular set of books. Sometimes it's these are really difficult stories, these things that I'm telling here. And it's been pretty visceral writing them because these characters have been living inside my head for quite some time. And I've been living this pain with them.
Yeah, and that's something that to kind of go back to the book proper, that this book is visceral. I mean, I haven't read the other books yet because they're not out. But having read Random, I mean, this is a book that is somewhat deceptive at first. And I don't know if that was intentional, but like you'd be open with the chapter in which Jazz has a rather amusing turning moment in which he... I won't ruin it because I think people just need to read the opening chapter, but it's funny. But then it switches to this just really dark, very real, just horrifying experience. I mean, I got bullied in school. I don't know about you, Julia, maybe you did too, but, like a lot of that, like I'm not aware, but I could understand some of those experiences of the teasing and the brutality of that. And this book deals with that in a very nuanced way. But out of curiosity, the way in which it's structured, did you think of that as somewhat deceptive with that opening chapter?
Like I said, I started writing the short story, and most of that first chapter's background happened as I was thinking about the random aspect of it, and that was the beginning of it. And then the world just grew up around me. And in one sense, there is... I never let go of that amusing stuff. There's a lot of funny threads going throughout the thing. There's a scene in the second book, which is followed through in the third book, which is actually hilarious, under the context of the book. But again, at the same time, it is deeply visceral, in the sense that it connects to a much deeper layer of experience than just, you know, being amusing. And in some ways, the Harry Potter books went through this because they started out being very funny, very middle grade, very, you know, light, amusing kind of stuff. And then eventually he winds up dying and being reincarnated.
Right. He becomes Jesus.
Yes. Well, I don't have a Jesus in my books, but yeah. But the thing is, I think characters grow up, or at least the best characters grow up, and even if you start out being very light and frothy and funny and kid-like, they grow up in the sense that a lot of that's still there, but it gets subsumed into, I'm a grown-up now. And the coming-of-age books in particular, the young adult books in particular, have got a very solid dose of that. If you take a look at things like The Hunger Games, which is the big thing now, I mean, Katniss is no longer young. Her experiences have made her older than some of the old people in that book. And yet it's still a young adult book. It's still this coming of age bridge that has to be crossed. And I don't think that a lot of the time we're giving enough credit to our kid readers because they keep on saying this is too difficult or this is too tough or this is too hard or this shouldn't be given to children to read. But children grow. And they understand this on a level that most grown-ups can only remember understanding because they've already been through this whole process.
Right. And I think that's definitely true, that the coming of age thing, it necessitates having a character start out in one younger place and end up in a far older and wiser position. One of the things that struck me while reading this is that there is a lot of stuff around bullying. It's not just from the classmates at school, but it's even institutionalized. And when Jazz is trying to figure it all out, there's a real sense among the kids in the book that you can't necessarily place your trust in adults to protect you. So they're kind of learning how to get around bullies together and build teamwork on their own. And I thought that was really interesting and important to show, because I think the reality for a lot of young people is that you can't necessarily, if you go to an adult and try to get help for things that you see injustices in the world, the result might not actually be that you get help with that, even if their intentions are good. And so working together with people your own age is a good idea. Were you consciously trying to do that, or was that something that just sort of happened?
I think that in some ways kids get kidded by the modern society in a lot of ways, because in earlier days, in historical times, your 12, 13, 14-year-olds were grown-ups. There was no such thing as this extended teenage childhood phase that our children grow through now. You grew up faster, you grew up harder, and you learned a lot of things by going through them as opposed to being told about them, which is what a lot of our children live through by definition. And I'm not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing, but young adult as such, they are still being, in a way, treated as children. And I kind of never was, and I never wanted to be, and that's the audience that I'm writing for. The kids who essentially know themselves and understand themselves and are learning to understand themselves from the inside. I'm writing for the reader. There was a book buyer in a New York bookshop that actually told me something that resonated. "You're writing," she said, "for people who already know how to read." I'm writing for those people who will recognize things and learn with the word that I'm writing, rather than sitting back and expecting to be taught it to them in nice bite-sized chunks. My vocabulary tends to run riot, you might know this. but I write for children who don't... I write for children. I write for readers who don't mind learning a word from context, as opposed to going, "I don't understand this, I'm giving up right now."
Yeah, and I think that's a level of trust for the reader that a lot of people don't give, and that I know definitely as a young reader myself, I was really looking for people to trust me with, to trust that I could figure out words from context or that I'd be able to get the story. And that led me to read adult books faster than maybe I was supposed to, according to librarians or whatever. But I think that what you're doing is really good, because I think that I'm not the only person like that. I think there are a lot of kids out there right now who can read that and who are feeling maybe like they don't fit in the world. And this is a book that says, hey, there are other people out there who take you and trust you as a person.
I never really, I blew through the kids section of my library before I was 7. I was reading adult books by the time I was 10. My father gave me a book, which I know I've got it written down in the flyleaf as a dedication. This was after I learned English, so it's like 3 years after I learned English, and the book is this thick, and it's a doorstop, and it's got a flyleaf, an inscription on the flyleaf for my father, who is basically giving it to me, and it's the complete unabridged Foresight Saga by John Galsworthy, which is a Nobel Prize winner tome in English, in my second language, and I was reading that at 13.
Wow! Yeah. So you were definitely advanced, and you're writing for the readers who are a lot more like you.
Yep.
So this brings me to another thing that I was wondering, since our theme this year has been World SF, and we've been trying to find out about science fiction and fantasy all over the world. And I know that you came to the United States when you were 10 and you learned English as your second language. I maybe got this wrong. Well, no, you can correct me. But okay. The question I have is, when you say you blew through the children's library section by the time you were 7, so what did you read? What kinds of things did you actually grow up reading?
Everything. In my house, the rule was, if you can read it and understand it and enjoy it, you can have it. There was no restrictions. There was no upper shelf. There was nothing like that. I was just permitted to read what I wanted to read. I was reading things like, but I grew up in, no, I didn't come to the States when I was 10. We moved to Africa when I was 10 because my dad got a job with the UN and he was working with the UN there for 2.5 years in Zambia and then 5.5 years in Swaziland. So we kind of moved around a bit. That's where I learned English. I was steeped in the literature of a different continent, and I was reading Polish writers and German writers and Swedish writers and all that kind of thing. In translation, obviously, I don't speak all these languages fluently. But I was reading all these grown-up things. I was reading things like Kristin Laverne's Daughter, which is a medieval Norwegian saga, which is like 1,000 pages long. It's another doorstop, when I was 12 or 13 years old, and I loved that. But I think partly that was what pushed me towards fantasy, things like that, because I loved historical fiction passionately. There was all this wonderful stuff that was going on in those old times that was completely beyond my understanding, but I loved reading about it. But I read everything. When I started, and this is my mom calling, so you might have to live with this. Do you want me to stop until she finishes?
Kitties, they're so fun.
I think it's just part of the character of this podcast.
Yes, okay.
This particular set of cats has now decided they want to have a fuss out there somewhere, and they've been hissing at each other for half an hour.
Well, you know, that's what cats do. My cat periodically attacks me in the middle of recording, so don't worry.
You try reading with cats in the house. That's an interesting thing. When the cat decides that I'm important and the book is not, I'm in the middle of the book right here. And, yeah, that happens.
But yeah, my cat will occasionally paw at the pages, sort of be like, oh, what are you doing reading? I'm going to bat at the page so you can't read that now.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's me. It's all about me. Put the book down. But the thing about reading is that I have been told that long before I could actually physically read, I would be given a book and that would keep me quiet. I would sit there and I wouldn't rip and I wouldn't tear and I wouldn't do anything that a baby would do with a book. I couldn't read, but I would be very carefully be sitting there and turning the pages and looking each page over very carefully. So you might say that I was doing this since I was literally born, just about. Reading has been, I'm never without a book. I go to a waiting room and I've got a book in my bag. I'll go to the subway ride and I'll pull out a book and I'll read. I'm never without a book. I'm always reading something. And I think that a lot of the times when people ask me, the advice you would give to young writers, and I would just go read. I think that's the way to learn. There's no school for writing. Reading is a school for writing.
I would agree with that sentiment. I think more people should read, but you know, I'm not the emperor of the world, so I can't make that a rule.
Neither am I. Otherwise, I would.
Out of curiosity, and this is gonna be a sort of more general question. Given that you have spent a great deal of time sort of in your life moving about the world, I mean, you mentioned that at 10 you moved you lived in various parts of Africa. I'm curious, in what way has this sort of movement in your life affected your writing? Not just this particular book, although I think there are some obvious connections, but just in general.
Well, the novel before these, the latest novel before this new series, it was called Midnight at Spanish Gardens, And Spanish Gardens was real. It was a place, it was the worst kept secret of my university years. I went to university of Cape Town. And this was a place which had no signposts, no signs, no nothing. You had to know exactly where it was before you could get there. And it was just passed on from generation to generation. You had to turn this down this blind alley where you would normally steer well clear of because it didn't look safe. But you had to go down this alley, and there was a tiny little courtyard at the end of the alley, and it opened up into this magnificent place called the Spanish Gardens, which was a really mangy old cafe, which, you know, people still remember as preserved in amber. 30 years and after the fact, people who have gone their separate ways across half the globe will describe it to you in almost exactly identical words. It's that kind of place. And that found its way into a book. Quit!
Now!
Sorry, cats. But the thing is, that found its way into a book because it was such a completely magical place in the fabric of reality that what I call the veil between the worlds was very thin there. And I'm very good at finding places where the veil between the worlds gets to be thin and dragging people through it, whether they want to come or not. I think that my traveling around such a lot, what it did do is it trained me to look, it trained me to observe, and it trained me to find an understanding of something that was palpably unfamiliar very quickly because I needed to do that in order to survive in it. And in that kind of sense, it was invaluable training for a writer, particularly a writer of fantasy.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Julia, do you have another question?
Well, sure. So you mentioned that this Random is the first book of a trilogy of the books about the random wares and the ware shifters in general, the ware kind. So when can we look forward to seeing the second and third books?
Well, the second book is in-house right now being edited, so hopefully early next year. The third book, like I said, I just finished writing. I'm still busy polishing up the rough edges of it. But I wrote book two and book three this year, so I wrote pretty much 200,000 words this year without stopping.
Wow, that is a lot of words.
Yeah, and like I said, these characters are amazing. And Mal, I kind of fell in love with Mal a little bit. He's such a wonderful character. He's a point of view character, Wolf. He's the, just to give a grounding, he's the older brother that has a problem. He's the one that he doesn't turn. He hasn't turned by the time that most normal weird kids have turned. So he's the oldest unturned weird of his generation. And that in itself is almost enough to make him the butt of a lot of jokes. And he's getting really desperate about it. And he takes matters into his own hands and changes things radically. But he is very vulnerable, and he is very, he starts out young, but he ends up in a position of almost power, almost before he's ready to handle it. And he's a fascinating character, and I can't wait for Wolf to be out there. And as for the third book, Shifter, it's about a character who is somewhat unique, even in my own weird world, in that he is a true shifter. He's not a weir. He's not tied to the moons. He's not tied to the cycles. He can literally turn into anything he wants to when he wants to.
Wow.
And this is not something that is either common or shall we say, acceptable. He's very alone. And let me put it this way. By the time I finished book three, there's more stories in this world. This arc is done. This story is done. But there may be a second trilogy in here.
Well, that sounds exciting. So will we learn more about the science behind how wares work?
Yes, in book two, in Wolf, I actually go into the genetics of it because I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler. They're trying to figure out how to reverse the effects of a were who has lost the ability to turn. And what they do is they literally come up with, a vaccine, which they give to this character. I won't say any more than that. give to this character, who is essentially lost the ability to be the second half of herself. And they literally kickstart her genetic mechanism again so she can re-become the Weir that she was.
And of interesting. Course,
there's no guarantee of success anywhere in this, because this has not been done before as such, and they don't know what the hell they're doing. And they're basically just winging it and hoping and praying and holding it together with duct tape and the knowledge that they've got of how things work. And I go into the well, not the details, obviously, but I go into the background of this genetic possibility here. And in the end of Wolf, you will really be looking at the person next to you on the subway and thinking, could you possibly be a wolf when you're not? Because these guys, these Weirs, they're so real. They're so possible. They might exist for all you know. How do you know that your neighbor who goes away for 3 days a month is not somewhere in a turning house?
I don't think my neighbor goes away for 3 days out of the month.
How do you know?
Because it would be very quiet.
Maybe your neighbor shifts into a frat boy.
That is entirely possible. And that would go very much with some of the things that do happen in Weir. Sorta. Just be a very different version of it.
So I have one more question for you, Alma. And this is very different to any Weir shifter type thing that I've ever seen before.
Yes.
Have you liked reading about Weir creatures before, and do you have favorites that you were inspired by, or was this just something that came to you? What's your background with shifters and Weirs?
I come from the Balkans. They have shifters there for a very long time. The whole setup is mine. It's pretty much an original Weir world. The trope is there, but none of the rest of the things that you associate with them, you probably won't find it in there. I've just created an entirely different basis for it. And I love to hear you say that you've never seen it before, because that makes me happy. I've created something new.
You definitely did. Even from the very first prologue part of the book, it's very clear that this is, I was like, okay, werewolves. No, not werewolves at all. Wow, this is completely different, completely new.
I kind of love these books with a gooey love. You know how they say, which is your favorite book? And the most authors will tell you the book you're working on. And that, in a sense, is true, because I'm still working on this series. But at the same time, I really do think this is some of the best stuff I've ever done. This is some of the best writing I've ever done. And it's certainly some of the most important stuff that I've ever done, given the issues that I'm dealing with, given the themes that I'm dealing with. And given the hopes that I've got, it might help deal with these issues and some of the readers who might pick up the books.
Well, excellent. So I think we're going to have to start winding down, because I know Julia supposedly wants to eat food. just unacceptable.
I have to be fed or else I can't be on podcasts. I'll waste away, Sean.
No, you won't. No. We'll just artificially, we'll throw food at you through a doorway or something. I don't know.
I don't think that's going to work.
I don't know. Probably won't. So this book, Random, I believe is already out. And if it's not, it'll be out probably by the time this goes up. So it's out. You should go buy it.
I think it's there. I think I looked for it today and I found it available to buy online. So everybody listening should be able to buy it.
Because I think it went out a little bit earlier in October, didn't it?
It's available as ebook. The print version is still coming up, but it's available for pre-order right now.
Okay, as of the 27th of October.
And if you have an e-reader, you can get it immediately, because I did look for it and found that I could buy it from my phone immediately if I'd wanted to.
Okay, well then that's currently available. But you noted that there are two other books in the series, and those are obviously going to be coming. So let people know when they can expect the next book.
I'm hoping that Wolf will be out by early next year, maybe February, March next year. And I don't quite know when the last one is scheduled for, but I'm very much hoping that I can wrap the series before Worldcon so I can take it with me there.
Ooh, awesome. So I know also you have a bunch of other books that are out and available for people to buy. Why don't you pitch some of those to us?
Well, there's the one I mentioned already, the Midnight Spanish Gardens one, which essentially centers around a whole what-if question, and it swings around the idea of you get to live two different lifetimes, and then you get to choose one of them. Which one would you choose? And what is really important in your life, and what would you fight to keep, and what would be okay to lose if you could get the rest of it right? There's a lot of discussion about this novel out in the cyberspace right now, and every single reviewer who has ever reviewed it started saying, well, it made me think about what I would choose if I had to. So that's a good good starting point right there. And like I said, Spanish Garden was a real place, so it's almost like going home again in a different way. My other books, my other fantasies include another young adult series, the World Weavers series, which has the first three books out, Gift of the Unmage, Spell Spam, and Cybermage. And it features Native American mythology, Nikola Tesla as one of the main characters, and a race of elves with the souls of Ferengi. I had a lot of fun with those. And the fourth book in that trilogy, so to speak, is supposed to be coming out before the end of the year as well. So I had a lot of irons in the fire there.
All right, excellent. So we have lots to look forward to. So where can people find you online? Do you have a website or a blog?
There's a blog on my website, and it's at www.almalexander.org. And a lot of my other haunts from on the internet can be picked up from there. I've got, obviously, a Facebook author page, doesn't everybody. I'm on Twitter, so, you know, come along and say hi wherever. I'm all over the place, really.
Everybody's on Twitter now.
I hate Twitter. If I could say something in 140 characters, I wouldn't be called a novelist.
You heard it here first, folks.
And it sounds like you're actually planning to be at WorldCon this year. Are you going to be anywhere else or just WorldCon?
Well, I'm going to be at Oricon, which is in, 10 days now? In Portland, Oregon. And I'm usually at RadCon, which is in February in Pasco, which is Eastern Washington. But that usually depends on whether or not I can get through the passes and I'm not snowed in. The weather, it's a very weather-dependent con. but other than that, I'm probably going to be doing a guest teaching stint at Odyssey Workshop this year on the East Coast. And I'm trying to organize a mini book tour to go with that, so I don't have any details about that yet, but I'm probably going to be in and out of various places on the East Coast sometime in the summer.
Excellent, excellent.
Great.
So people got a lot to look forward to then. And of course, WorldCon is basically in your neck of the woods. So
it's in my backyard. It'll be silly not to go to WorldCon, which is 6 hours drive from me. So
yeah, it's easy. It'll be no problem. No problem. Unless the whole world freezes over like day after tomorrow.
Well, like I said, you already said that the world ended yesterday, so we're all living on borrowed time anyway.
Exactly. Well, so thanks so much, Alva, for taking the time to talk to us about Random, giving us a chance to read it, too. I appreciate it.
I'm glad you guys enjoyed it, and I'm so glad you think it's new.
Excellent. And thanks, Julia, for being my co-host this round.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thank you, Alma. That was a fun book to read, and it was a really great conversation.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And on that note, guys, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death. in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.